People thought we were weird, but no one really cared enough to ask questions. Grace and I had been divorced for 8 years, yet we still shared the same apartment. To outsiders, we looked like two exes who had somehow managed to stay civil. Civil, right? That word doesn't even come close. My name is Ben. I'm 33 years old, and for the last 8 years, I've been living in a cage. Or sometimes it feels that way. It all started after our divorce. I was about to move out when Grace told me in her usual cold way, "If you leave, I'll hurt your mother." She knew my mother was everything to me. Bedridden after a stroke, she couldn't even speak properly, let alone protect herself. So I stayed. Grace was a master manipulator, sweet and charming when needed, but behind closed doors, she became someone else. The first few months, I thought maybe things would get better, but it only got worse. At night, she locked me in the basement, just a dim bulb overhead, no windows, and the smell of damp concrete. She knew I had a fear of darkness since I was a kid, and she used it against me. "Oh, you like it down there, don't you?" She'd laugh from the top of the stairs. "Keeps your mind sharp." I tried to fight back in the beginning. I really did. But Grace had her ways. Wet bread. That was her weapon. I have a rare allergy. Something about yeast and water mixed together creates a violent reaction on my skin. She discovered it by accident one day, and she never let me forget it. Once she pinned me against the wall and smeared wet bread across my arms. I screamed in pain, and she just told me to shush, holding a finger to her lips. "Don't wake your mother." I should have called the police, but how do you explain this kind of madness? Who would believe a grown man locked in the basement crying about soggy bread? One day, I mustered the courage to tell my friend Raj over the phone. I kept it vague, just said things weren't right at home. Grace overheard. That night, she didn't lock me in the basement. Instead, she sat me on the sofa, placed a damp piece of bread on a plate, and said, "Tell me what you told Raj." I trembled. I couldn't look her in the eye. She leaned forward, pushing the plate closer. "Eat it." I couldn't. I threw up instead. That was the last time I tried telling anyone. Over time, she trained me like an animal. Every time I did something she didn't like, out came the wet bread. Just seeing it made me freeze. She even convinced our neighbors that I was mentally unstable. "Poor Ben," she'd say with a fake pout. "He still thinks we're married." My breaking point came when my mother died. Grace didn't tell me right away. I found out 3 days later when the hospital called about funeral arrangements. I sat on the floor holding the phone, sobbing. "I want to go to her funeral," I said. "You'll make a scene. She wouldn't want that," I begged, cried like a child. I even offered to wear handcuffs so I could just stand beside my mother one last time. Grace laughed. "You're not going anywhere." That night, I decided to run. I waited until she fell asleep and crept up the stairs and slowly opened the front door. I was one step away from freedom when I felt something wet slap the back of my neck. I dropped to the floor, convulsing, my skin burning. My body curled into itself, and Grace stood above me. "Nice try," she whispered. I don't know where I found the strength, but I grabbed my phone and dialed 911. "Please," I cried into the receiver. "She's hurting me. Please send someone." The cops came. Grace opened the door, calm as ever. "Officers, I think he's having one of those episodes again." She handed them fake documents, papers claiming I had schizophrenia, printed with a forged doctor's letterhead. The officers took one look at me, sweaty, disheveled, arms covered in rashes, and nodded. "Sir, we need you to calm down." I screamed that she was lying and I wasn't crazy, but they didn't believe me. No one ever did. It's been 2 years now. Grace brought someone new into the apartment. His name was Elijah. Mid-30s, gym-cut arms, and the kind of confidence that's always mistaken for charm. At first, I thought he was a friend. Then I saw them kissing in the kitchen. I froze. "I don't mind, Ben," she told him. "He likes to watch." She made it worse with each passing day. laughing louder, touching him more, whispering just loud enough for me to hear. It was deliberate. Elijah didn't know what I was, who I was. Grace told him I was mentally challenged. And then came that night. They were in the living room. I was on the floor nearby, supposed to be sorting books or whatever. She started unbuckling his pants right in front of me. Elijah laughed, unsure. He's just sitting there, he whispered. Grace turned her head to me, smiling with those dead eyes. Don't worry. He doesn't mind, does he? And then, with slow deliberation, she dropped down to her knees. And suddenly, something snapped. Maybe it was rage, maybe it was grief. I stood up calmly. Elijah looked at me, confused. What's he doing? Grace was busy. I kicked him, hard, right between the legs. He screamed in pain. The crack of pain that came from him felt holy. He collapsed backwards, gasping, clutching himself. Grace shouted, spitting blood, and I tried to get up. I was already at the door. I didn't stop this time. I ran barefoot through the streets. I didn't know where I was going, but I knew one thing. I was gone. That was 3 months ago. Now I have my own apartment. It has windows, sunlight, and I control the locks. I have scars, sure, but every morning I wake up, make toast, and I laugh because I can. Bread no longer terrifies me. As for Grace, she's under investigation. Elijah, turns out, had secrets of his own. The cops finally listened after he showed up at the precinct, bruised, humiliated, and shaking. The truth has a funny way of surfacing. On December 9th, 2023, a dispute in Florida led to the arrest of psychiatrist Heather Neely, 58, for allegedly assaulting her ex-husband with wet bread. The 70-year-old victim told police that during an argument, Neely soaked slices of bread in water and threw it at him, leaving his shirt wet and covered in pieces. When questioned, Neely denied any altercation but could not explain the wet bread in the trash. She was charged with battery on a person who was 65 or older, a third-degree felony. However, prosecutors later did not pursue the case, citing insufficient grounds for prosecution. Neely had been ordered to have no contact with the victim and to wear an alcohol monitor. I hadn't lived in this quiet neighborhood for nearly 3 years, always keeping mostly to myself. My name was Liam. At 25, I was something of an enigma to the residents around me. I preferred it that way. My apartment was small but comfortably chaotic. It was my haven. Here, I painted my face in vivid, unnatural colors, etched tattoos onto my skin, each a memory, each a rebellion. Music filled the tiny space with loud electronic beats as I danced erratically, losing myself in rhythms that freed my restless spirit. My neighbors thought I was strange. Their wary eyes and whispered conversations as I passed confirmed it. Perhaps it was the vibrant face paint, the elaborate tattoos, or my habit of shouting lyrics into the night. I didn't care much. Isolation suited me just fine. I didn't need their approval. Then she arrived, Emma. I had first seen her through my kitchen window, moving boxes with her family into her small house across the street. She seemed ordinary enough, the kind of neighbor who blended seamlessly into the tapestry of normality around here. She had the aura of someone who upheld societal norms, who fit into neat boxes, the ones that I deliberately rejected. It was an accident, truly, when we first crossed paths. One evening, lost in thought, my face freshly painted in chaotic streaks of yellow and blue, headphones blaring electronic music, I walked straight into her. "Watch it," she snapped, recoiling sharply. Her expression transformed from shock to disgust, eyes darting over my painted face and tattoos. "Jesus, what the hell are you supposed to be?" I paused momentarily, startled. The street was quiet around us, her voice carrying like an accusation. "I'm sorry," I muttered, genuinely taken aback by her harshness. "Sorry isn't enough. Have some decency, some basic civil manners. You're scaring everyone around here," she hissed. I felt a flush of embarrassment mixed with anger. My appearance had never been a source of shame before, but her contempt stung. She marched away briskly, shaking her head in exaggerated disbelief. For days afterwards, her words replayed in my mind. Emma's disdain represented everything I despised. The judgmental normalcy, the relentless pressure to conform. Slowly, embarrassment turned to resentment. Resentment to anger. I wanted to strike back, to rattle her complacency, to show her exactly what fear looked like. I plotted a revenge that fit my personality, darkly theatrical. The next morning, I pulled on a long black gown. I fashioned a crown from dried thorns, pricking my fingers in the process. The tiny droplets of blood felt fitting, like sacrifices to authenticity. I picked up a Chucky doll I'd bought impulsively from an oldie shop months earlier, its grotesque, grinning face staring blankly ahead. As Emma stepped from her house, heading for her parked car on the curb, I emerged from the sunlight. She froze at the sight of me, her eyes widening in disbelief and terror. I could sense her heartbeat accelerating, see the tremor in her hands. What are you doing? She stammered. You don't get to judge me, I screamed, my voice echoing down the otherwise peaceful street. You don't get to decide what's decent and what's not. Stay away from me! You're insane! She shouted back, fumbling with her keys. Am I scaring you, Emma? I yelled, stepping closer. Maybe now you'll learn what real fear's like. Maybe you'll think twice before judging someone again. Her scream pierced the morning air as neighbors opened doors and peered through curtains. Emma dropped her keys, trembling as she scrambled to retrieve them. Help! Someone call the police! She screamed, but my fury, once unleashed, wouldn't relent. Call them! See how you treat people who don't fit into your perfect little world! Two squad cars screeched to a halt, officers quickly stepping out. Put your hands where I can see them! One officer shouted, his hand resting cautiously on his holster. I lifted the Chucky doll above my head, laughing bitterly. You gonna arrest me for being different? Drop whatever's in your hand and step back now, the officer commanded sharply. Emma was now safely behind the second officer, pointing at me. He's dangerous. He threatened me. I dropped the doll, the plastic clattering loudly against the asphalt. Raising my hands, I stood defiantly, allowing them to cuff me without resistance. As the cold metal tightened around my wrists, I looked straight at Emma. This won't change who I am, I said quietly. Remember that. Inside the police car, I watched the street slowly turn to normal. Neighbors retreating behind their doors. Emma stood hugging herself, talking animatedly to the officers. Yet, a subtle uncertainty lingered in her eyes. Then, one evening, a knock startled me. Opening my door cautiously, I was surprised to see Emma standing there. She looked different, less assured, less aggressive. What do you want? I asked. She hesitated, her eyes meeting mine briefly before dropping to the ground. I wanted to apologize. I stared, unsure of how to respond. I overreacted, she continued quietly. I judged you unfairly. I've thought a lot about it since then, and you didn't deserve what I said. A strange feeling washed over me. Why the change? Emma shifted uncomfortably, meeting my eyes with honesty. Because you made me see something I'd forgotten. Freedom. Living without fear or judgment. Emma began to visit me often, initially just curious, watching silently as I painted my face, dancing wildly to chaotic beats and expressing myself without restraint. Soon enough, her curiosity ignited into participation. Together we painted ourselves with vibrant, fearless colors. Emma's laughter echoed freely, her hesitation replaced by raw, unfiltered joy. Tattoos began to find their way in her skin, symbols of newfound liberation. But the neighbors didn't appreciate her transformation. Whispers grew louder, judgmental eyes harsher, and no one was more critical than her husband, Mark. Then, one evening, the tension erupted violently. I heard screams echoing from Emma's house, and I rushed across the street, bursting through the unlocked door. I found Mark gripping Emma by her hair, his voice a storm of fury. "Enough of this madness, Emma," he roared, pulling her roughly. "Look at you. You're humiliating me. Humiliating us. Change back to who you were." Emma's eyes blazed with defiance and anger. "I won't be your perfect little puppet again." He tugged harder, causing her to scream in pain. Something inside Emma snapped. With shocking speed and fury, she lunged at him, her hands finding his throat, pressing hard. Mark gasped, his eyes wide in shock and terror, choking under her grip. "Emma, stop!" I shouted, stepping forward, her face wild and fierce, softened as her eyes met mine. "This isn't the way." Slowly her hands released, and Mark fell to the floor, coughing desperately for air.
I can't stay here," she whispered, her body trembling from adrenaline and fear.
"Then we won't," I replied softly. "We'll leave this place behind." That night, beneath the moonless sky, we packed only the essentials and set off, leaving behind the neighborhood, its suffocating normalcy, and our past lives. On the morning of March 5th, 2024, a Florida woman faced a bizarre and terrifying encounter on her way to work. Ruth Bullard, 74, called 911 after a man wearing a crown of thorns and carrying a piñata began screaming profanities at her. The incident left her emotionally shaken and in tears. Authorities identified the suspect as Gregory Zopoff, 37, a known local offender with a lengthy criminal record. Zopoff denied any wrongdoing, claiming he was only singing and dancing his leprechaun song. Arrested for disorderly conduct, he was booked into jail on a $150 bond. Just days earlier, he had pleaded no contest to threatening patrons at a deli after they refused to give him money.
When we moved to the new villa, we had no idea just what we were getting ourselves into. It was a stunning, luxurious manor in the higher-end part of town. The kind of place you would only ever dream of owning as a child. But for a wealthy and respected family like us Williamses, it was perfect. From the outside, it looked like any other 19th century villa, with a beautiful white stone facade, pillars, and huge bay windows looking out into the expanse of land around it. But inside told a different story. We had no clue about its real history, about the dark secrets waiting to be spilled from the shadows. Things seemed fine when we first moved in. Myself, my wife, and our daughter. Waking up to those stunning views in a beautiful old house was the picture of perfection. Naturally, it was an old house, and it had its own quirks. Its creaks and groans, the soft howl of the wind through the roof and its echoing footsteps. But at first, we thought nothing of it. Old houses did make noises. Until the whisper started. I would wake in the middle of the night, hearing a voice speak close to my ear, even when my wife was still fast asleep, tucked into the covers on the other side of the bed. "You'll regret this." The voice would speak in a haunting whisper, barely audible over my own thumping heart. "You don't belong here." At first, I thought I was imagining it, like I was caught somewhere between dream and reality, and was hearing voices conjured by my own mind. But those whispers followed me out of my dreams and into my waking reality, too. "You shouldn't be here. This house doesn't belong to you." The voice sounded like it belonged to a young boy, but it was difficult to make out when the whispers were always so faint, more like a breath on the back of my neck or dancing along my cheek. It was only ever me who heard them too, when I was alone or when everyone else was asleep. I casually brought it up to my wife one morning, but she just looked at me like I was crazy and brushed it off as nothing. "Stress from the move," she said flippantly, and that was the end of it. But the longer we stayed in the villa, the more I felt as though we weren't alone. It wasn't just the whispers, flickers of movement in the corner of my eye, glimpses in the mirror, shadows that didn't belong. I tried to ignore it as much as I could, until one day my own daughter came to me crying about seeing a strange boy standing in the corner of a room. Fearing we had an intruder, I rushed to her bedroom and threw open the door. but there was nobody there. I even checked under her bed and inside the closet, but both were empty. She pointed to the corner of her room, her eyes wide and glassy.
That's where he was, Daddy. A boy was standing there. I'm not lying.
About a month after moving in, we started finding the letters. They would be sitting out on the kitchen table, or unassumingly placed in areas where we would find them. They were more like notes, really, scribbled in blotting ink that looked old. But it's what the letter said that unnerved us the most. I'm watching you. You don't belong here. Leave before it's too late. Whoever was leaving these notes, they were putting them directly inside the house, which meant someone was breaking in to leave us these strange, threatening messages. And for what reason? Because they didn't want us living there? It made no sense. The letters gradually began to grow worse. They started detailing things that nobody else should know but us, mentioning the activities my daughter had been doing the day before, or giving a detailed description of my wife's clothes throughout the day, including some very personal details. It was like someone was inside the house, watching our every move, and making sure we knew it. I went as far as setting up a brand new security system, and every night combed through every single room in the house searching for an intruder. But I found nothing. There was no possible way anyone could be leaving these letters, yet we kept finding them. Between the whispering voices, the threatening notes, and the shadow constantly hanging over me, I was starting to lose it. I couldn't stay in this house any longer. The last straw came when I was working in my office one afternoon and heard my daughter scream from outside. I dropped everything I was doing and ran out to see what had happened. I found my daughter sprawled out in the grass, sobbing hysterically. Assuming she'd been injured, I ran over to her.
What happened? Did you fall? Are you injured?
I asked in a panic. She sobbed, raising her hand.
The well. I saw him in the well.
She was pointing towards the well we had at the very edge of the garden. It had been sealed off, but some of the bricks had started to crumble, leaving gaping holes. What are you talking about? I asked.
The boy I saw in my room. I saw him in the well.
I didn't understand how that could be possible, but I told her to stay where she was while I went to investigate. My heart fluttered in my chest as I approached the crumbling structure, digging my phone out of my pocket and switching on the flashlight function. I stood at the edge of the well and shined my phone into the gaps of the brick. There was nothing down there but dark, stagnant water. But just as I turned off my flashlight and pulled away, I thought, for a fraction of a second, that I might have saw a face peering up at me from the dark water below. There was something unnatural happening here at the villa, and I didn't want to put my family at risk any longer. We moved out a few weeks later. It was sad to say goodbye to such a beautiful manor, but the inside was full of dark shadows and eerie whispers, and I knew we couldn't stay there. In 2014, the Broadus family purchased a dream home in Westfield, New Jersey, only to be thrust into a nightmare. The mysterious letters began arriving, signed by The Watcher, who claimed to have been monitoring the house for decades. These cryptic notes included eerie details about the family and their children, calling them young blood. As the letters grew more threatening, the family's fear intensified. Despite police investigations and neighborhood scrutiny, the identity of the Watcher remained a mystery. Unable to live in the house, the Broaduses eventually sold it at a loss. To this day, the chilling case remains unsolved.